ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 8, and verse 1. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Vanam Vivekshu Putreshu. Varyam Nyasya Sahaivava. Vana Eva Vasachantas. Tritiyam Bhagam Ayushaha. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, Vanam, the forest, Vikshu, desiring to enter, Putreshu, among the sons, Bhayam, wife, Nyasya, entrusting, Saha, together with, Eva, indeed, Va, or, Vane, in the forest, Eva, certainly, Vaset, one should dwell, Shanta, with a peaceful mind, Tritiyam, the third, Bhagam, division, Ayushaha, of life. Translation, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, one who desires to adopt the third order of life, Vanaprastha, should enter the forest with a peaceful mind, leaving his wife with his mature sons, or else taking her along with him. Purport, in Kali Yuga, a human being generally cannot live more than 100 years, and even this is becoming most unusual. A man who has a reasonable expectation of living for 100 years may adopt the Vanaprastha order at the age of 50, and then at the age of 75, he may take sannyas for complete renunciation. Since in Kali Yuga, very few people live for 100 years, one should adjust the schedule accordingly. Vanaprastha is intended as a gradual transition from materialistic life to the stage of complete renunciation. Next to having adopted the Vanaprastha order of life, one should arrange one's sustenance by eating uncontaminated bulbs, roots, and fruits that grow in the forest. One may dress oneself with tree bark, grass, leaves, or animal skins. Purport, a renounced sage in the forest does not kill animals, but rather acquire skins from animals who have suffered natural death. According to a passage from Manu Samhita quoted by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the word medya, or pure, indicates that well, residing in the forest, the sage may not accept honey-based liquors, animal flesh, fungus, mushrooms, horseradish, or any hallucinogenic or intoxicating herbs, even those taken as so-called medicine. The Vanaprastha should not groom the hair on his head, body, or face, should not manicure his nails, should not pass stool and urine at irregular times, and should not make a special endeavor for dental hygiene. He should be content to take bath in water 3 times daily and should sleep on the ground. Thus engaged in the Vanaprastha, one should execute penance during the hottest summer days by subjecting oneself to burning fires on all 4 sides and the blazing sun overhead. During the rainy season, one should remain outside, subjecting oneself to torrents of rain. And in the freezing winter, one should remain submerged in water up to one's neck. For one who engages in sense gratification must perform severe penances at the end of life to counteract his sinful hedonistic activities. A devotee of the Lord, however, naturally develops Krishna consciousness and need not subject himself to such radical penances. As stated in the Pancharatra, if one is worshipping the Lord properly, what is the use of severe penances? And if one is not properly worshipping the Lord, what is the use of severe penances? If Sri Krishna is realized within and without everything that exists, what is the use of severe penances? And if Sri Krishna is not seen within and without, then what is the use of severe penances? Translation, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, one who desires to adopt the third order of life, vanaprastha, should enter the forest with a peaceful mind, leaving his wife with immature sons, or else taking her along with him. So this chapter is dedicated to the vanaprastha ashram. And the previous chapter was describing the householder. And of course we also have the brahmacharya ashram, we have the sannyas ashram. As I explained yesterday, there is a gradual progression according to qualification. So the sudras don't do anything except get married. So they only have one ashram because they're not qualified to study the Vedas, nor are they qualified for any sort of renunciation. And as we go up from Vaishya to Kshatriya to Brahmana, then there's more qualification, and gradually they're allowed to take more of the ashramas. And so finally, when we come to the Brahminical stage, the Brahmin can take, or should take, the Brahmacharya ashram, then the Grihastha, then the Vanaprastha, and then the Sannyasa ashram, which indicates that the Sannyasa ashram is the most severe, and not many people are qualified for it. And second to that is the Vanaprastha ashram. And some people are qualified, but still, it is also somewhat restricted. And we see here in these verses that actually if one follows the rules of Vanaprastha, it is quite strict. One has to do very severe austerities, and not many people can do this. Even nowadays, anyone cannot even imagine living like this, eating the roots and the fruits in the forest and sitting in the water up to the neck in the wintertime in the Himalayas or whatever. Very, very difficult for even the Nagababas to do. Huh? So this is just the Vanaprastha. He's not even really renounced. He's just preparing for renunciation. He's doing this. So it is quite severe. So this is, of course, these rules are quite common. We'll see these rules mentioned in different Puranas and in the Smriti Shastras, Manu Smriti, etc. These are the duties of the Vanaprastha, which means a concentration on tapas or austerity. And as the purport mentioned, the reason for this severe austerity is to create detachment from household life, which indicates that household life, even if it is grihastha household life, that is the done according to varnashramic rules, has a tendency to create attachments, material attachments, which are unfavorable for liberation. So, therefore, from this we can understand that even the grihastha ashram, where we have so many rules of restriction, even that will create attachments which are unfavorable for spiritual advancement. And therefore, this severe penance takes place in the Vanaprastha ashram. And we will see in the whole progression from Brahmachari to Grihastha to Vanaprastha to Sannyas, the theme is detachment. So the brahmachari is detached. He can only eat with the permission of the guru. He has to live very simply. He cannot wear shoes. He cannot use an umbrella. He cannot wear perfumes, etc. He has very simple cloth. And he's dedicated to studying the Vedas. So he learns great renunciation. Then we have the grihastha ashram. The grihastha ashram has what we call license for sense gratification. But then there are restrictions. Many, many rules are in the Smriti Shastras. They're there to restrict the grihastha. So everything is governed by rules. According to time, certain things at certain times can be done, at certain times things cannot be done. And there's a procedure for everything you do, from getting up in the morning to bathing to eating. Everything is guided by rules, which direction to face, and what to eat and how to eat and whatever, how long your toothbrush should be. And everything is rules. Huh? The Samvedis toothbrush, well, of course, they have sticks for toothbrushes. So the Samvedis is so long, and the Rigvedis is so long, and the Yajurveda one's so long. Everything is guided by rules. Huh? And even in Hari Vilas, Bhakti Vilas, you'll see rules that you could urinate in this direction, but not in that direction. It's whatever. So there's many, many rules for every aspect of life for the Grihastha. Hmm? Why? To create purity. Huh? Restriction and purity for the Grihastha. Why? Because the Grihastha ashram is basically impure. So there are rules to purify everything. Huh? And then we come to this. And then finally, after 50 years or whatever, there's different prescriptions. One is when your children are grown. Huh? When your children are over 21, I suppose, and they are self-sufficient, then you leave the house. Or when your hair gets gray, you leave the house. Or when you feel renounced, you leave the house. So, there are different prescriptions. Anyway, sooner or later, if you're qualified, then you have to take vanaprastha. That's the prescription. Of course, not everyone is qualified, so the sudras are not qualified. And even the vaishya is not much qualified. Now, it's very popular, we'll see in the Bhagavatam, with the kshatriyas. So many of the kshatriyas take vanaprastha, like Bharat Maharaj and others. They went to the forests and did severe austerities. So the kshatriyas are capable of doing this because they have strong determination, very strong willpower. We have the vanaprastha ashram, and the emphasis is upon austerities, tapas, restricting the body in different ways. And one of the restrictions, of course, is that the food. One eats very simple food, roots and fruits, etc. One dresses in tree bark or animal skins. It's the things you find in the forest. You don't cut the hair and the nails. You don't groom yourself. So you don't try to look beautiful. And you live in a very simple hut, and then subject yourself to the changes of material nature. You sit out in the hot sun in the summer, and to increase the effect, you even put fire all around your body, and you have fires on all four sides, and put fire on your head, and just sit there in the sun in the summer. Now, this is quite a famous tapasya, actually. And if you go to the Kumbh Mela, you will see some sadhus doing this. They're sitting there. Of course, it's not so hot during Kumbh Mela. But you'll see them with a fire. They have a metal pot with some ashes in it on their head. They don't have fires all around. They'll be sitting there in the middle. So this is one type of tapasya. And then in the when it's raining out, you sit out in the rain. And in the winter time, you jump in the river up to your neck, and you stand in the river for a long, long period of time. Huh? So very, very austere and subjecting the body to all sorts of extremes. So as I said, it is not very practical for most people to do, especially in the modern world. And even in ancient times, we see that it wasn't that popular. And as of the last 1,000 years, not so many people did it also. So, as is quoted here in the purport again, that ultimately, what is the use of all this tapasya? Very, very difficult, very severe, etc. But ultimately, not very useful for the Vaishnava. So in the Nectar Devotion, Rupa Goswami says that vairagya is not an anga of bhakti. Even though we say we have to control the senses and be detached, etc., we have regulated principles, still, it says vairagya is not an anga of bhakti, because it doesn't create bhakti. And rather, it could be detrimental to bhakti. So those who practice these type of things and then may become yogis or whatever, it becomes unfavorable for bhakti. So the reason is that these type of austerities often make the heart hard and dry. Whereas the process of bhakti is to make the heart soft and melt with prema. So in this way, these great austerities can be unfavorable to bhakti. And instead of creating bhakti, they do the opposite and drive one away from bhakti. So what this means, hardening of the heart or drying up of the heart, means that instead of developing bhakti and affection for Krishna, one can develop attraction for renunciation, detachment, and liberation. Simply become absorbed in liberation, in other words, impersonal Brahman, as a result of all of this. So therefore, that is unfavorable for bhakti. And therefore, it is not recommended. On the other hand, we do find there are prescriptions for some sort of austerity for the Vaishnava. So the Vaishnava's austerity is Ekadasi and fasting on the appearance days of the Supreme Lord. This is the austerity of the Vaishnava. So we see that is not such an extreme austerity as this type of austerity, not very extreme. That, of course, is not an ashramic austerity, whereas the Vanaprastha ashram itself, the whole ashram is based upon austerity. So the Vaishnava, of course, in one sense, is beyond ashramas. It's beyond varna and ashrama. So the Vaishnava simply concentrates upon worshipping the Supreme Lord. And other aspects may or may not be favorable. He could be inside the varnas or outside the varnas, or with the ashram or no ashram. This has not become significant. The main point is surrender to the Supreme Lord. And we gauge the advancement of the Vaishnava not upon his ashram or his varna, or absence of it, but his surrender to the Lord, the degree of surrender to the Lord. So the more I surrender to the Lord, then we give him a higher status, and the less surrender, we put him a lower status, without regard to ashrama or varna. So, and that means that varna and ashrama are secondary to bhakti. We cannot judge a person on varna and ashrama, but we judge the person on his devotion. Why? Because the devotion is the means by which we attain the Supreme Lord and service to the Supreme Lord, and not ashrams and varnas. In themselves, varnas and ashramas can ultimately lead to liberation. We do the vanaprastha, and we develop great detachment, and then we take sannyas and give up everything. So you can get liberation that way. In the Bhagavatam, of course, these things have been modified, so we see that they are dedicated to the Supreme Lord. So within these ashramas, one must also worship the Supreme Lord quite prominently. Whereas in the normal varnashram system, that prominence is not there. But the Vaishnava groups, the different sampradayas of Vaishnavas, they create more devotion in their ashramic duties by worshipping the Supreme Lord. So anyway, the very prominent in the vanaprastha is the sense of tapasya, so that one can become renounced and give up the attachments of household life. So as far as bhakti is concerned, yes, bhakti also recognizes that material attachment is a problem. So how do we deal with it? So the varnashramic way of dealing is to just go through the ashramas and eventually take sannyas and become very renounced. How does bhakti deal with it? So the nature of bhakti is it produces vairagya. Whatever you get from vairagya and jnana, you get in bhakti without the negative effects of those things. So automatically, bhakti produces vairagya and jnana without hardening the heart. So what this means is the process of bhakti, as I said, is a progressive surrender to Krishna. So that surrender to Krishna means I'm doing everything for Krishna. I'm surrendering my body, mind, and senses and atma to Krishna for serving Krishna. So what's for myself? Nothing. So there's renunciation. So instead of saying I won't do this and I won't do that and I won't do this, you know, and I'll restrict all my senses, and to enforce that I will sit in the water for 5 hours in the cold water to stop my senses, or sit in the hot sun with the fires around me to stop my senses. Instead of doing that, we offer everything to the Lord. So Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, but when he took sannyas, what he said is, he quoted the prayer of the Avanti Brahmana, who was a householder, and he got kicked out of his house and everything. And he got so depressed that he left the house and he took Vaishnava sannyas. So then he began singing one song, the song of the Avanti Brahmana. And there is one verse that Lord Chaitanya quoted when he took sannyas. And in that verse it says that real sannyas means to offer everything to the Lord. Okay? So instead of simply rejecting everything, we offer everything to the Lord. And we accomplish the effect of renunciation by engaging everything in the service of the Lord, including our body, mind, and words, and atma. So this is Bhakti Vinod calls this Sahaj Vairagya, the natural process of renunciation, by offering everything to the Lord. So this, of course, takes place by degrees. If you have a little bit of surrender, that means we're not offering very much to Krishna. And we're still not controlling our senses. And when we progress, we get up to nishtha, and we got more offering to the Lord, and some sense gratifications. And when we go further into ruchi and asakti and bhava, that means more surrender to the Lord, and very little attachment for ourselves. So vairagya is complete by that stage. Very little for ourselves, and everything for Krishna. And when we get to prema, everything for Krishna. The vairagya is complete. But the goal of bhakti is not vairagya. That is only a secondary byproduct. Liberation is not the goal of bhakti. It is a byproduct only. So the goal is give everything to Krishna. And when that is perfect, then we have no attachment to anything for ourselves. So therefore, the vairagya is complete at that stage. So when we perfect bhakti, then it automatically vairagya is there. So therefore, in one sense, one does not have to strive separately by other means, except dedicate oneself to the Supreme Lord more and more and more. Now, we can do things which are favorable to that surrender, so therefore we do have rules. You cannot do this and you cannot do that and whatever. We have rules for controlling the senses. So our basic rules are the four regulated principles. That much we follow. And then, of course, then we have other rules we follow also based upon that. And an individual can make more rules if he wants to. Concerning what to eat and how much to eat and whatever. We're going to have so many different rules. But to make it simple, we have the four regulator principles as the basis of sense control, which is favorable to bhakti. And then the concentration is upon hearing, chanting, remembering, worshipping the deity, association with devotees, etc. So we have all these different angas of bhakti. So these angas of bhakti, they create more bhakti. Renunciation does not create bhakti. Simply controlling the senses does not create bhakti. Impersonalists can also control their senses. They don't get any bhakti from it. But the processes of hearing, chanting, remembering, etc., they create more and more bhakti, which means more and more surrender to Krishna, and consequently, more renunciation. So, therefore, this is the general process of the devotee. The concentration is upon execution of the direct angas of bhakti. And this produces the renunciation. So for that reason, Lord Chaitanya ultimately rejected the varnas and ashrama as the essence of bhakti. When Lord Chaitanya went to Udupi and he met the descendants of Madhvacharya there, and they had a discussion, what is the essence of life? So then the Acharya of the Madhva Sampradaya says, follow the Varnashram system. And Lord Chaitanya said, no. Bhakti is the essence. Nevertheless, we see that Lord Chaitanya took sannyas, and all of his followers were somewhere situated doing their activities according to some varna and ashrama. Usually grihastha ashrama and vaishya, kshatriya, brahman or sudra, they were doing different duties within the system at that time. Yeah, so they followed those duties as long as it was not an obstruction to bhakti and did not contradict the rules of bhakti. They followed to that degree. At the same time, they could also give up everything. So we see that in the Goswamis, Rupa and Sanatana and Jiva Goswami. Gave up everything. No varna, no ashrama. They simply practice bhakti. So that's an example of disregard completely for the ashramas. So, to some extent we can follow, yes, but we should not be overly attached to those rules and regulations. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, yes, we follow to some degree. We can call these secondary rules of bhakti, gonavidhi. Whereas we have mukya vidhi, that is hearing and chanting and remembering. Hearing, chanting, remembering, etc. They produce bhakti and increase bhakti. The gona vidhis do not do that. Bathing does not create bhakti. You can bathe all day and bathe all night. It doesn't increase your bhakti. But we bathe anyway. So we follow the rules of varnashram in general. In general, where we follow the rules for cleanliness. So concerning the body, yes, we follow the rules of brushing the teeth and wearing cloth and bathing and whatever for maintaining the body. We follow the varnashramic rules as much as possible. So that is the physical rules. And of course, then we have interactions and social rules we have. So to some degree, we follow those also. So there are rules of conduct between people in society. There are rules within family, how husband relates to wife, wife relates to husband, children relate to mother and father, etc. Idea of respect and whatever, and how one treats the family members, all that we take from the Varnashram system in general. Okay. Samskars, you follow the samskars, we do that also. But if there's worship of devatas, we reject that and we only worship the Supreme Lord. In this way, we do take some of the rules and utilize them in a very flexible way, without any obstructive or contradictory elements in them, for the maintenance of the body, for interacting in society, for maintaining family. Yes, we use them, but without great attachment. And they can also be given up. So we will see that the advanced Vaishnava may give up all the rules, and he may not follow the rules that we follow, and we may criticize. He's not taking a bath at the right time, or he's not doing this properly, whatever. It doesn't matter. He's beyond rules and regulations. The person in prema is inconceivable in his conduct. We cannot even understand what he's going to do next. So we cannot predict what type of activities he's doing, nor can we criticize. So anyway, we follow, in the stage of sadhana, we follow these secondary vidhis to some degree. In that we have a body and we're in a society, so we follow these rules. At the same time, the emphasis is upon the bhakti. So one can give up svadharma, the rules of one's particular ashrama and varna, without any sin, if we are doing bhakti. But we cannot give up bhakti. If we do all the dharma without bhakti, useless.
And if we give up our dharmas and we only do bhakti, no sin incurred, even if we don't get perfection. So bhakti is an independent process. And we can take favorable elements from varnashram. At the same time, we don't depend on them. So that is the basic siddhanta of the Vaishnavas in the Bhagavatam. Okay. Who's ready for Vanaprastha? Of some sort. We don't have to do this, but at least renounce children.
Just wanted to ask a question. You mentioned to how this form of devotees are actually gradually progressing from Brahmacharya to Grahastha and gradually going towards Vanaprastha. And here you mentioned about going to forest and all that.
Yeah.
Where does it lead from for a form devotee or devotee in particular who wants to go to the Vanaprastha? Obviously, the wife and children are there. It's not practical in this way to leave them aside, I suppose, in one sense, to another.
Well, if they're grown up,
yes.
And they can, and then the children take care of the wife. Then one can leave the wife there. Or the other thing is, Va says here, you take the wife, and voluntarily the wife also does austerities and sits in the water and puts the fires around her and all this stuff. Anyway, I don't think anybody in the modern world, even 500 years ago, followed the system. I don't know. Maybe we see in the Bhagavatam they did do this, like Bharat. He was very strict. But in recent history, I mean, even in the last 1,000 years, I don't think many people follow this Vanaprastha conduct. Very, very difficult for most people. But to some degree, they follow it in the sense that the husband and wife will go to a holy place like Vrindavan or Varanasi or somewhere and just sit there and, you know, do spiritual life in the last days. That much they would do. Separate themselves from family members. But, of course, we see maybe in the last 300 years, even that has probably disappeared. And most people are attached to their family members up to the point of death. To the grandchildren. It comes to the grandchildren now. After the children are grown up, then they become attached to the grandchildren. They can't leave them. So, but what that does is, that means that then we end up our life with attachments. Which means that's where we begin our next lifetime, with attachments. So we get caught again in grihastha life again. So this is some sort of guarantee that one can gradually, birth after birth, get out of that attachment and become very, very detached and then take sannyas and then get out of the material world. Oh, yeah. Well, we can offer, we can respect the Devatas. We should never disrespect the Devatas. In the 64 Angas of Bhakti, in the Nectar of Devotion, in the second 10 rules is, don't disrespect the Devatas. So we should never disrespect the Devatas. These are also devotees of the Lord. At the same time, if we want to worship, we cannot contradict the worship of the Supreme Lord. So the process of worship is offer the prasad of the Supreme Lord to the Devatas if you want to worship. So we'll make an offering to Vishnu or Krishna, use that offering to worship the Devata. That way we don't create offense against the Supreme Lord.
Mm-hmm. And
with all the routine that they are doing, I find that they say that they are lacking in sleep so much that they become really sick. I heard mother be saying that when I go to visit my mother, all I do is sleep to catch up the lack of sleep I've had at that point. So the lack of sleep is so much that they are sick, they are not able to do that.
Yeah, well, I think that maybe you have to discuss their program. I don't know. It's not reasonable that children are going to have to do such great austerities because they naturally need more sleep. That's my opinion anyway. You know, they need maybe 10 hours of sleep a day. So if you start over-training them when they're too young, you create problems.
Yeah. But I'm talking about not children. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about people, say, 18, 25, 15, that range, or even a little older, even 35. Oh.
Yeah. Well, they have to be trained to some degree. Everything is a matter of training, I think, also. Now, of course, there are different physical types, and some people just may need more sleep, no matter how much they get trained. So that's another thing. Yeah. The system has to be a little flexible, also. Yeah. But one can be trained to, you know, sleep less or whatever to some degree, but we can't go beyond reason. Yeah, then one has to see. Well, we have to see a doctor, and maybe you can see what is practical for them, you know, and see if sleep is a problem. That, you know, because of getting, maybe it's not the sleep, or maybe it is the sleep. And if it is the sleep, then they have to get more sleep. Yeah, that'd be practical. That's all. There are many definitions. And even husband and wife, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, if the husband is submissive to the wife, that's wrong. That's also illicit sex. Yeah, so we can go to that extreme on one side. You know, so there's that, you know, you can have many, many degrees of what we'll call illicit sex. Well, naturally, jnana and vairagya are produced by bhakti without any extra endeavor. We can say that jnana and vairagya are necessary also for bhakti. But we'll see that that is maybe an overstress, because as Rupa Goswami says in Nectar of Devotion, that actually they may be a little favorable in the beginning of bhakti, but ultimately we concentrate upon the angas of bhakti, which give bhakti. Because vairagya does not give bhakti in itself, nor does jnana. Of course, by jnana we mean just simply understanding we're not the body, and impersonal jnana, that type of jnana. Of course, Bhagavat jnana or Sambandha jnana is necessary for bhakti. That is part of bhakti through the hearing process of sravana. Now, we may interpret those words jnana and vairagya in another way, of course. And to say that jnana means, of course, Bhagavad jnana is necessary. So we need some Sambandha jnana for advancement. And vairagya in the sense that too much addiction to sense enjoyment also is unfavorable for bhakti, so we do have to restrict to some degree. But we don't go to the same degree as this, you know, this type of vairagya.
What are the symptoms of
hard-hearted? This means then we become indifferent to the sweetness of Krishna. We're more interested in simply getting peace and emerging into Brahman.
Daily practicing Krishna consciousness.
Oh, hard-heartedness and daily life. Well, I would say indifference to bhakti itself will result from hard-heartedness. That we're not much interested in hearing, chanting, remembering, worshipping the deity. We're just more interested in being peaceful by ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why he has to be the spiritual life,
which is in
to see? To see Krishna, which is inferior.
You mean a Vishwarupa?
Yeah, it wasn't to say Krishna, it was to say the Vishwarupa.
Yeah, so Vishwarupa is an inferior form.
So why does he need
Inferior form. Vishwarupa is inferior form.
Why do you need a spiritual life to be inferior?
Not spiritualized, inferiorized. He became specialized to see Vishwarupa instead of seeing Krishna, because otherwise he would never see this form. So he gave him eyes to see as the devatas see, which are lesser eyes to see the form of Vishwarupa, because it's a lesser form. Actually, the Vishwarupa is to be meditated on by inferior yogis, and superior yogis meditate on Paramatma. But of course Arjuna is superior to yogis, even mature yogis, because he sees directly the form of Krishna. So his eyes are very spiritual. So he needs special eyes to see Vishwarupa. Otherwise he has no interest in that.
Which is inferior. So which is inferior. He wanted to see Krishna in
a lower form. Yeah, Vishwarupa is a material form.
Why does he want to do that? Why does he want to do that?
Oh, this is only part of the overview of all different processes. So we have Karma Yoga and Bhagavad Gita, even though ultimately it's rejected. And we have Jnana Yoga and Bhagavad Gita is also rejected. Astanga Yoga is rejected. So all these different forms are there of vibhutis in the material world. Krishna says, I am the Ganga, I am the Asvata tree, I am the shark, or whatever, I am the different things. So in the material world, you can look at things and see Krishna also. That's also inferior. And then we have the Vishwarupa, which is, as I said, for immature yogis. See the Lord as everything in the Lord, and the Lord as the universe, and also an inferior form. What is that? Example of? Well, the example of bhakti is that he desired to see Krishna in a fighting mood. So he got that, he was able to see him in the battlefield in a very ferocious manner in virya rasa. So that much, the devotional aspect. Ultimately, to fight against the Lord is not bhakti. So usually it's demons that fight against the Lord. It's not even, well, we do have a secondary rasa called virya rasa, and we have rodra rasa, anger. And bhayanak rasa, fear, which are secondary rasas. But those actually don't really manifest even with the demons. It's a very, very secondary in that case, because these rasas are in the spiritual world with devotees. But it's only a semblance of fear. For instance, if Krishna disappears for 5 minutes, the devotees become fearful. So in that sense, it's not with demons. So we have fearful rasa or anger rasa. The gopis become angry at Krishna momentarily. So it's not that enemies and Krishna have anger. That's not really rasa at all. So sometimes the devotees do have these relationships of secondary rasas, virya rasa and whatever like that. The cowherd boys fight with Krishna sometimes, very intensely. They'll fight with each other. And we'll think, wow, they're hating each other. They're fighting in such a way. Different contests they'll have. Very, very intense. But then it is part of their sakya rasa, ultimately. So we can take that Bhishma's also like that, and he's fighting against Krishna, but it's a display of virya rasa.
He's not a real enemy. He's obviously the devotee of Krishna. Because we see at the end, he says, I only want to see Krishna when I depart from my body. So he was never, in any sense, hostile to Krishna at all. So it's a manifestation of some secondary rasa there that he wanted to experience. Well, one can take sannyas from brahmacharya ashram, grihastha ashram, or vanaprastha ashram. That rule is there. Okay? Madhvacharya, of course, takes as a brahmachari. Ramanuja as a grihastha. I don't know who took as a vanaprastha. I don't know if there's any examples of that, but that vanaprastha is also there. So it can the rule is from any ashram one can take. Yeah, that's his Shankaracharya's version. Because for the impersonalists, the whole goal is detachment from material energy. And the only way we can do that is by complete renunciation. And only with that detachment you get liberation. Whereas the process of bhakti, our goal is not detachment but surrender to Krishna. Well, what does it mean? The whole universe is satisfied? On all levels of satisfaction. So if the Lord is satisfied, everybody is satisfied. In one sense, yes, the Lord satisfies one materially. But of course, that's a temporary level, because material satisfaction is temporary. So then higher than, of course, we have the spiritual satisfaction. So if the Lord is satisfied, then people become spiritually satisfied. Those who are qualified will develop spiritually. So on different levels, according to the qualifications of the people, they will get different results. And of course, if the Lord is satisfied, all the devatas are satisfied, which means the devatas give everything to you. So the example is given of if you worship the root, then all the leaves and the branches get, if you put water on the root, everything is satisfied. You worship the Lord, then all your material needs are taken care of by the Lord, plus spiritual needs. So, in this way, if a person worships the Lord, then that satisfies all the devatas and everything, and you get all your material things. So, like that. What is that? Well, those who are want material things, they get their material satisfaction, and those who want spiritual satisfaction get spiritually satisfied. That's all.
In the conversation between Krishna and the gopis, when they meet in that solar eclipse,
mm-hmm.
Krishna meets them. In that, there is one purport in which it's mentioned that Jnana Yoga simply causes suffering for those who are fully immersed in pure law of Godhead. So I couldn't understand this.
Jnana Yoga creates suffering for those who are... Yeah. So in other words, actually Krishna recommended to the gopis that you're separated from me, so you can be very satisfied by understanding that I am everywhere like the Akash. I am spread everywhere. I am all pervasive. So you just meditate on this and you will be satisfied. And this was very dissatisfying to the gopis. So what are you doing? You are telling us to be Brahmavadis. How could you do that? So that's painful for them to get jnana, instructions on jnana, when they're far superior to that. Okay? So for a devotee to get instructions on jnana is useless. So that was a test of Krishna, we can say. He did the same thing when he sent the letter of Uddhava to the gopis. He said, you meditate on Paramatma, because Paramatma is in everybody's heart. So the gopis thought, well, now Krishna's telling us to be yogis. How can that be? So actually there's another meaning to the words also. So there's the superficial meaning, and then there's the real meaning of the words underneath that. So Krishna has speaking double. So the gopis eventually understood there's another meaning, because this cannot be the meaning. Okay, Hare Krishna.